This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
I'm Sarah Crown.
And I'm Claire Armistead.
And this is the Guardian's Haycast, coming to you from just outside the Guardian's luxury porter cabin, where we're sitting on the grass. We're hidden behind the newspaper stand on the site. And today we thought we'd introduce you to the rest of our team, who've been squeezed in here for the last 7 days.
Charlotte Higgins has been keeping her eyes open for our Hay Diary. Natalie Hanman's been going to all the most thought-provoking events of the festival. And Alison Flood has been keeping an eye on the literary side of things. But Alison, you haven't just been listening to novelists, have you? You also found time to listen into Monty Don in an emotional moment.
Yes, so he was talking about his writing and his gardening, and then Peter Florence started asking him about his battle with depression, which he's struggled with since he was a teenager, and Monty Don was incredibly open and honest about it and actually almost broke down at one point.
Completely offsetting that, I had a lovely green room moment when Jackie Wilson, who is, as we know, the Queen of Hay, went rushing up to him and wanted her photograph with her friend with him.
Well, I saw Jackie Wilson actually in action at an event later that day, much more cheery thing. It was Jackie and other authors championing their favourite puffin of all time, and the audience were voting for their favourite. So Jackie Wilson was doing The Family at One End Street. We had the TV presenter Jason Bradbury on Owen Colfer. I think Marcus Brigstock probably put together the best campaign, though. He had the children very excited. He was with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
I have a question for, particularly for the younger people here. Do any of you like chocolate or sweets?
I rest my case.
And later on, we discovered that the audience had voted Goodnight, Mr. Tom as their favourite, and I was delighted.
So, Nat, you were particularly impressed by John Gray talking about his essay collection, Gray's Anatomy, I think, weren't you?
Yes, he made an interesting argument for uncertainty. So while you could say we've made technological and scientific progress over time, it's much harder to say we've made ethical and political progress. So he was really arguing that the world might be a better place if we embraced life's mysteries.
There have been great improvements in the last 100 years and over human history in general. We live longer. Many people in the world are healthier than they've ever been. Women are emancipated, which they weren't throughout most of human history. But all of the gains, I try to argue, of this kind in ethics and politics can be lost. In other words, life in society, human life, is not on the whole cumulative the way science is cumulative. Progress is a myth. And if you live inside a myth, it looks like a fact. All these gains can be and probably and almost certainly will be reversed, because the normal course of human history is not steady improvement. The normal course of human history is more like shocks, jumps, abrupt discontinuities. And I think actually we're in the middle of an abrupt discontinuity now. And the reason I think the basic illusion, it's a kind of quasi-religious belief in progress, is in fact the only real religion of lots of people.
Charlotte, a couple of themes have come out of this week, and one of them has been about history.
Yeah, history's been a really strong news story this week, actually. The first thing that happened was that Niall Ferguson came and gave his campaign for the history curriculum. And Michael Gove, the education secretary, was in the audience and leapt up and said that he was delighted and he wanted to do it and he wanted to employ Niall Ferguson as a consultant for the new history curriculum. And then there have been lots of other historians talking about it too. So Simon Sharma seemed a bit disappointed that he wasn't going to be devising the new history curriculum. And Anthony Beaver was around and he said he thought it was a jolly good idea. And then we had ancient historians.
That's your area, isn't it?
That is definitely my area. Getting very angry and saying that Niall Ferguson knows bugger all about ancient history. So it's all been quite controversial and fun. So,
Claire, you actually chaired an event with Anthony Beaver earlier this week, didn't you?
Yes, and we were talking about the whole sweep of history, not just to one book, because, of course, he's the military historian par excellence of the 20th century. And I got him together afterwards with the Orange Prize-winning novelist Helen Dunmore to talk about the relationship between fact and fiction. Helen, I thought we'd start with a rather lovely quote that you have, which is about the way that people's real history gets forgotten and official stories begin to be told. And the line is, "What has happened to you is not as important as you think. we intend to tell this story in a different way. That's really chilling, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's about who controls the past and who's allowed to tell their story. That's clearly a very potent thing when we're discussing the stories of the Soviet Union.
I have to ask you this. Do you approve of each other? Anthony, you've been quite rude about faction, haven't you?
I have, but I thoroughly approve of Helen's books because I think they're absolutely scrupulous. She invents her characters. She does not grab real characters from history and then tries to novelise them or put words in their mouths. And that I approve of 100%. Like, as we both agreed, Justin Cartwright's book on Adam von Trott and Isaiah Berlin, where he changed the names. And that gives a distance. So people know that it's not the full truth. And I think the danger today is that some of these historical novels are so convincing and so effective in that particular way, and they're based on good research, but they're filling in huge gaps, and we don't know what is filled in, what is invented, or what is not.
Helen, you do have history going on in the background, don't you? I mean, there are real events. How do you handle these real events in a fictitious setting?
Well, to me, history is far, far more ever than the background. It's the texture, it's the climate, it's the present moment in which these characters live and have their being. And their relationship to history is that of people who are immersed in it and who are participants in it, who possibly do not control it. They don't take an overview. They are not people who have the power, as it seems, to transform events, and yet they are transforming. They are constantly transforming them. I'm particularly interested in the civilian witness, the private individual, to not only show us what history feels like on the pulses, but also to lead us perhaps to look at our own lives very differently, I think.
You raise a very interesting point this morning, Anthony, about women and the testimony of women being actually in some ways more valuable than the testimony of men who tend to posture.
I think that's true. I think that men, shall we say, suffer more from the problems of self-image, and therefore, particularly when they're talking about the past, they feel a need to control that past and to exert a degree of control which perhaps they never had at the time. And I found, particularly, say, with Russian eyewitnesses, the women were always the most reliable because they were actually recording what they had seen and what they had experienced without any of this retrospective influence which the men tried to impose.
So humiliation it actually leads to self-mythology, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, you know, that is something which, of course, men cannot really live with very easily. And that's why I think then quite often unreliable witnesses of the past. It's also another reason why you need to go for contemporary sources rather than interviews done many years later. And this isn't because of a dishonesty necessarily, it's people have refiltered their own experiences through the many books that they have read on the subject at the time. That's why for the book, for D-Day and the Battle for Normandy, I really felt it was essential to go back to the diaries, the letters, the reports of the time, to find out what people really felt rather than what they felt obliged to feel so many years later.
Because we are all contaminated by hindsight.
Yes.
And in a way, fiction can do something that possibly history cannot do, which is to return to that moment and create an illusion of being there, fully embodied in that moment.
Anthony, you said something very interesting in your talk, which was that you thought that the evidence now from the Iraq War, or modern history, is being erased because of the technologies in which it's recorded. So, for example, emails would all be junked, and therefore it's going to be very difficult for the historians of the future to record this particular moment of history because there won't be the documentation.
It's true. I mean, there is a terrible paradox in the way that we all want to get at the information, or certainly journalists do, because there is a compulsion for journalists to almost write history on the hoof. But that actually has the opposite effect, because it means that ministries, government departments and headquarters are determined to make sure that all the embarrassing bits are removed. In the past, everything was boxed up at the end of, say, of a campaign, sent back to the archives, and then it would be weeded or re checked 30 years later when people would not be quite so paranoid. So I think that historians are going to have a very difficult time in the future. But also on the digital side, it's so easy to eliminate stuff straight away. And I think it's going to be very hard for historians in the future to write a proper assessment of something like the Iraq War in comparison, say, to writing about the Second World War.
Do you think, Helen, that this might mean that the novelist has a whole new lease of life, the historical novelist?
It's entirely possible, but I suspect people are still keeping documents and are still keeping evidence because there is something about people. I'm often astonished by quite how much people do hang on to very compromising information. That email is still there, and you think, if that were me, I'm not sure I would have wanted that to go down to posterity. But people have this, it's an innocent ego in a way that we want our version to survive, don't we? We want our version to be the one that survives.
One of my fears is that people kept diaries because they knew they were living through such an important moment of history that they recorded everything. Now, that is perfect material for a historian. What one fears now is, you know, is the blog going to be valid in the future? Because the blog, in fact, is written for an audience and therefore written for effect. And I don't think that blogs in the future are going to be at all a reliable source for a historian in the way that diaries were in the past.
No, and to a diary you can confide what you ought not to be saying. And that is something I'm very interested in particularly in writing about the Soviet Union, is this the public language, the private language, what you can say within the walls, what you can't say, and how is stuff preserved? I think it's extraordinary, the sacrifices that people will make, actually.
Or the dangers they put themselves through.
Yes.
I mean, for example, I found in the Spanish Civil War, particularly with the Civil War, there was actually very little material, because if you were found, you know, you were a Republican, you kept a diary, and the Nationalists found it, you could be put up against a wall and shot, and vice versa. One element of corruption of the past is the way that we tend to impose late 20th, early 21st century moral judgments on a previous period. And that is the opposite of both what a good novelist or a good historian should be doing, of actually trying to get your feet into the boots or the shoes or whatever of the people of that period and understand what they felt and why.
My name is Roy Hattersley.
Charlton Poskett, the guy that writes the murderous mass books.
And my guilty reading pleasure is really deeply shameful.
I don't know how I dare tell you this.
I at least look at the Daily Telegraph every day.
Probably the Sun newspaper. Yes, I'm afraid I've only got a brain like a goldfish. It has to be short and punchy. Sorry, but that's the truth.
So I'm Andrew Dixon, and I'm here in the kitchen of 34 The Meadows in Hay. And I'm here with Chef Yotam Ottolenghi, who's very kindly come all the way down here to cook me lunch. Yotam, what's on the menu today?
So this afternoon I'm going to cook a green bean salad with mustard seeds and tarragon, which is one of my recipes from Plenty. And it's something that is quite light and seasonal and wonderful to have just now, because everything is in season. All these things are just growing now in the sort of a late spring bloom. So it's just you don't want anything else really this afternoon. And if you look outside, the sun is actually sort of shining.
Really shining.
So that's what you want.
Now, what you've done already is you've put some water onto boil. We'll be talking about that in a moment. Let's just talk about this kitchen, because we're in this strange... Well, I say a strange person's kitchen. A strange kitchen, you don't know. Apparently, the person who lives here does a lot of baking. Do you ever enjoy kind of rootling around
other people's kitchens? I wonder where all the baking goes on, because I don't see any... Yeah, there's a couple of ovens, and then there's a lot of baking tins here. So we've got a loaf tin. It looks like a 2-pound size tin. There is a 24, 26 centimeter cake tin. So there's actually quite a lot going on.
So
we stop being so nosy and move on to the French bean salad, right? In this little bowl, we've got coarse sea salt, we've got coriander seeds, nigella seeds, mustard seeds, garlic, red onion, red chili, a lemon, and some tarragon.
I'm just putting some ice into a bowl.
Ice ready for me, because as I said, the crucial bit here is not to overcook. So the warm beans can easily overcook if you don't drop them into ice immediately. We're going to blanch the French beans now. So we need a timer or someone to have a look at the clock.
Okay.
Andy?
I'm going to wait till my second hand
start
comes
the clock.
To 12.
You
start can.
The clock. Okay.
Jonathan, can you just tell me a bit about cookbooks and the kind of cookbooks that you enjoy? Do you enjoy reading cookbooks, other people's cookbooks?
Yeah, I love reading cookbooks, but I especially like cookbooks that have some sort of story told in between the lines, not just recipes, because I think recipes, there's just like a million recipes around. I mean, you know, you can Google recipes and there's just endless possibilities. But in actual fact, the recipes that are the most exciting are the ones that have a little bit of history, a family history or a story attached, something that you can actually feel that it comes from somewhere and then it sounds more credible. So I love, for instance, I love Claudia Roden's cookbooks because they're always really deep and meaningful. You know, she always goes into the history of whatever cuisine she's checking, whether it's Jewish or Arabic. I mean, when she goes into all these cultures, she's like a little scientist. She's digging and digging and digging. And so the recipes mean so much more than what they actually are. My chili, and then I've got some lemon that I want to zest. Yeah, we're almost there.
So it seems to me that all these greens that are in this food, I mean, hay is a really green place at the moment. I mean, that must be a kind of inspiration in a way, seeing all this amazing fresh produce from the farms around here.
Yeah, and you know, this is one thing that is really fantastic about being here this time of year. It's just so lush. I mean, it's just the end of winter. The winter is gone. It's the beginning of summer. You've got so many shades of green. It's amazing. I've been driving through Gloucestershire, first Wiltshire, Gloucestershire, and then coming here to Hay, and it's just like, it's mind-blowing how green it is. And I think we're creating like a miniature here in this bowl. So I'm tossing everything together. And again, look at the colors.
Absolutely amazing.
The
reds,
the chilies, the red of the onion, all those type of greens, and then the little seeds that sort of dot the beans.
It's absolutely gorgeous and is making me incredibly hungry.
So I'm going to taste it before you, just to make sure there's enough salt there. I think there is. What do you think?
Have a quick go. Grab one of those beans. I think it's absolutely right. A little bit of salt, but not too much. But those lovely flavours. So you've got the chilli, you've got the lemon, and the oil.
And you can just eat the whole thing, can't you? I mean, it's just, because it's so fresh, you just think you're doing a favour to yourself by eating that bowl, don't you?
What I think we should do is you should take this outside and go and sit in the sun and eat it.
I think that's a great idea.
I'm Robert Winston. This is the Guardian Haycast at the Hay Book Festival. And the last book which made me cry was rereading Anthony Beaver's description of Stalingrad because of the image at the end of this incredible deprivation, the bitter cold, children climbing out of the drains and the gutters and the cellars of Stalingrad, having survived there for 10 or more months in absolutely unbelievably miserable conditions with hardly any food and intense cold. And there's something about that image of the futility and brutality of war, which is a universal image. It's not just, of course, the last Second World War, but it goes far beyond that.
Charlotte, you also encountered history of a rather different type yesterday in the form of the explorer Ranulf Fiennes.
Yes, you might have thought he was here to talk about his latest climb up Everest or expedition to Antarctica, but instead he was here to talk about his amazingly long, complicated and twisted family history.
I was only about 1 year old when I got taken from the UK to South Africa for 12 years, and so my granny, who was South African, was full of telling us all about our Rathfelder and Murray relations in the Cape Province rather than the English ones. So it wasn't until I really got back to England, aged about 12, that I started realising it was a big family and that they had a castle up north and so on and so forth.
I really like the way you can point to a scene on the Bayeux Tapestry and say, that is my ancestor Eustace. because he's on the Bayeux tapestry, isn't he? Pointing,
yeah, it's him
indicating
with his flag
that William the Conqueror ought to go back.
And he's carrying the royal flag, and his, what you call it, coat of arms is the same today as it was then.
Do you think Fine's blood flows in the veins of the royal family? I ask this because there's a very amusing moment in the book in which you speculate that Edward II, who was of course gay, his lover was Piers Gaveston, and then managed to have a child, you speculate that it was actually a Fines who fathered the child of
Isabella. Well, he provably committed adultery with the Queen of England, Isabella, and was shut up in the Tower of London. And he escaped by abseiling out over the Thames. But later he came back and started having it away with Queen Isabella all over again. This time they did rather well and ended up shutting King Edward II up in a castle, not very far from here. And, you know, they became really the rulers of the country. And they did very well indeed. But unfortunately, when a king is still alive, even if he is shut up, he can come back to haunt you. So it's better to do away with him, but in a manner which is not detectable by sort of forensic scientists of the day. And therefore, this cousin of mine and his adulterous lady, Queen Isabella, had a novel method of doing away with King Edward II, which was quite unpleasant.
That was the poker up the posterior method.
Yeah, you said it, yeah.
Of all these extraordinary ancestors, some of whom I learnt about in A-level history, I mean, Lord Say and Seal, who was very present and very, very important in the English Revolution and in the Civil War, was an extraordinary character. But I wonder, which of these ancestors do you think is the most impressive? Which are you most proud of?
Well, there's several. At Agincourt, they did very well indeed, fighting for Henry V. Then there was, of course, at Bannockburn, the two Fineses in charge of the English army were really stupid and lost to the Scottish and caused that defeat. So you have that balances out the other one. But the one that you mentioned, William Fines, who's in Shakespeare, called Old Subtlety, was definitely, in terms of English history, he was the most important guy, because Cromwell wouldn't have existed without him. He had amazing sons, all of whom were generals in Cromwell's army.
They're great survivors, your family, aren't they? And I just wonder whether, or what difference it makes having a sense of these extraordinary people in your family, and whether that makes you behave any differently, whether that's, you know, whether it makes you strive harder as a person.
The only two that may have had a mental or subconscious effect on me would have been my dad and my grandfather, not the ones before that. My grandfather was brought up at the family castle near Oxford, which has been in the family for 660 years, unbroken. But he was the second son, so he got nothing. And if you were the second son, and there were eight of them, all you got was the choice of being a priest or a army bloke or into the colonies. And his second son was my dad. And my dad was killed in the Second World War, commanding the Royal Scots Greys at the Battle of Alamein and later Salerno landings and Naples and so on. So he was killed 4 months before I was born. If I'm doing an expedition and get a bit wanting to give up sort of thing in Antarctica or something like that over the past 40 years, I sort of think I'm being watched by my granddad and my dad, and I wouldn't want to sort of give up, which might make them sort of feel ashamed. So in a way, there is a hangover.
Right, that's it from us outside the Guardian's porter cabin on the Hay site today. Tomorrow is going to be our last Hay cast of the festival.
I can't believe it, Sarah. It seems to have gone so quickly.